One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from John Russell and Jill Robbins. Later, Faith Perlow presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Apple will make its iPhone 14 in India, the company said on Monday. The announcement comes at a time when manufacturers are moving production from China. Apple described the new phones in a statement, saying they have new technologies and important safety capabilities. The statement added, "We're excited to be manufacturing iPhone 14 in India." Apple showed its latest iPhone for the first time earlier this month. The new model will have a better camera, faster processors, and longer-lasting batteries. The price is expected to remain the same as last year's phones. India is the world's second-largest smartphone market after China. But Apple iPhone sales have not taken a large share of the market there. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is pushing for local manufacturing, a main goal for his government since he took office in 2014. Apple has bet big on India, where it first began manufacturing its iPhone SE in 2017. Apple has continued to put together a number of iPhones there. Apple opened its online store for India 2 years ago. Local media say COVID-19 delayed plans for a large physical store in India. The latest model will be shipped out by Foxconn, a major iPhone assembler, whose buildings are on the outside of Chennai, a city in southern India. By 2025, Apple expects India will produce 25% of its iPhones, reports the Press Trust of India. Sanyam Chaurasia of Canalys, a technology market research company, said Apple has been trying to diversify its supply chain for a while, but these efforts have grown in the last 2 years over trade sanctions between the U.S. and China. Last year, Apple manufactured around 7 million iPhones in India. Chaurasia said the plan to make more iPhones in India may also lead Apple to drop its prices for the Indian market, making it more competitive. "You can adopt a more aggressive pricing strategy if you manufacture locally," he said. Most of Apple's smartphones and tablets are put together by other companies with factories in China. But Apple started asking them in 2020 to look at the possibility of moving some production to Southeast Asia or other places after repeated shutdowns to fight COVID-19 slowed its movement of products. Apple has not released details, but news reports say the company planned to set up assembly of tablet computers and wireless earphones in Vietnam. Other companies are keeping or growing manufacturing in China to serve the local market. They are, however, moving export-related work to other countries due to rising wages and other costs, as well as the difficulty for foreign business leaders to visit China due to COVID-19 travel restrictions.
I'm John Russell.
At a health center in Zimbabwe, a large group of women holding babies hurried to take their places on wooden seats. Separately, a health worker took a different group of worried mothers and their children through a back door and into another room, quickly closing the door behind them. The women were all at the Mbare Polyclinic in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. They came to have their children vaccinated against measles during a deadly outbreak in the southern African country. But the women in the back room were getting their children vaccinated in secret because their religion bans them from using modern medicines. Healthcare worker Louis Foye said, "The measles outbreak saw children dying, so they are now coming secretly and we are helping them." More than 700 children have died from measles in Zimbabwe in an outbreak that began in April. Information Minister Monica Muchangwa said many were unvaccinated because of religious reasons. The government has announced a vaccination drive, but as with COVID-19, some religious groups are strongly opposed to vaccines and have worked against the campaign. Apostolic churches are among those that opposed modern medicine in Zimbabwe. Followers believe in prayer, holy water, and other measures to treat disease or cure illnesses. Foye said, "The male leadership of the church means women have no power to openly say no to instructions. Children are then in danger." The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, estimates that apostolic churches have around 2.5 million followers in a country of 15 million. Some permit members to seek health care. Many still resist it. A group of apostolic church members who are open to modern medicine has been trying to bring change. They advise women to go against church rules if it means helping their children. Deborah Mpofu is a member of the Apostolic Women Empowerment Trust. She said, "We encourage women to get their children vaccinated, maybe at night. It's really necessary for the women to protect their children." At the Mbare Health Center, one mother said people had learned from the misunderstanding about vaccines during the COVID-19 pandemic. The mother, Winnet Muzubera, said, "A lot of people were misinformed during the COVID-19 period. A lot of people lost their lives. So when I heard about measles, I just said, I have to take my kids to hospital and get them vaccinated." Mpofu of the Apostolic Trust said some church groups would permit them to talk with their members and share information on vaccination. One church leader, James Katsande, also agreed to let his followers take their children to seek medical care. But there was a condition. They should come to the church's leaders for blessings before going to a health center. Worldwide, the World Health Organization and UNICEF reported a 79% increase in measles in the first 2 months of 2022. The organizations warned that large outbreaks were possible. They said children and pregnant women are most at risk of severe disease from measles, but a vaccine prevents it easily. I'm Jill Robbins.
As the cooler days of autumn arrive in the northern part of the world, people are clearing out old plants and planning new gardens for next year. However, plants that spent summer days outside will also need help to return to the inside environment. If the plants have gotten larger than their original containers during their time outside, you can replant them into larger ones. Choose a container that is no more than 5 centimeters wider than the original, and replant them with fresh potting soil and then water. You can always divide plants like spider plants and flamingo flowers into 2 or more individual plants. Look for plants with root systems that clump together. They divide more easily. If you are having trouble removing the plants from their containers or pots, check to see if the roots have come through the drainage holes at the bottom of the pot. If they have, gently pull or cut the extra roots to help remove the plant. You can then divide the plants. Firstly, shake off any extra soil carefully. Secondly, find the connection between the root system and the plant's top growth and pull apart the roots gently. Or you could cut through them with a sharp knife. Be sure that there are at least 3 healthy leaves attached to the root system of each new plant. Lastly, place each new plant in its container. Be sure to use fresh soil mix. Water the plants well until new plants form. All houseplants that spent time outside should be moved to a shady area for a week before going inside for the winter season. This helps the plant get used to lower light levels. Continue to water regularly during this time. After a week, look for insects on the plant, especially under the leaves. Wash the leaves with water to make sure there are no uninvited guests, like pests. If you are still worried about insects, you can spray the plants with neem oil mixed with water and complete the move inside before temperatures drop below 12.7 degrees Celsius. Houseplants that have stayed inside all summer still need care too. Less sunlight and shorter days can slow their growth. Most indoor plants rest during the fall and winter. This means that they require less water and little to no fertilizer until the following spring. Do not overwater during this time. It could cause the roots to go bad. Check for moisture in the soil by putting your finger into the pot. If the top few centimeters are dry, then you can water the plant. Avoid cutting the plants until spring, as slower growth in the winter means slower healing. But you can cut any dead and dying leaves. Many houseplants are tropical, so they need more moisture in the air, called humidity. In most homes, during the winter, the air can be very dry because of heating systems. You can run a humidifier, a machine that produces moisture for the air. Place the plants in the room with the humidifier. Keep plants away from dry heating areas like vents and from cold areas of the house. Once temperatures are steadily over 15.5 degrees Celsius in the spring, you can safely move the plants outside again. I'm Faith Perlow.
Thank you. from VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we told how the group reached agreement on the position and powers of a national executive. They decided the executive could veto laws, and they decided the person could be removed from office if found guilty of serious crimes. We also told about the debate on a national judiciary. The delegates approved a federal system of courts and judges. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the country. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. Next, the delegates began to discuss competing proposals for a national legislature. This would be the most hotly debated issue of the convention. It forced the question of equal representation. Would small states and large states have an equal voice in the central government? The convention had already agreed that the national legislature would have two houses. It had not agreed, however, on the number of representatives each state would have in each house. The large states wanted representation based on population, but the small states believed they would lose power to the large states. They wanted representation to be the same for all states, no matter what the size. One day, Gunning Bedford of Delaware, one of the smallest states, looked straight at the delegates from the largest states. "Gentlemen," he shouted, "I do not trust you. If you try to crush the small states, you will destroy the Confederation. And if you do, the small states will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith who will take them by the hand and give them justice." The debate on legislative representation, big states against small states, lasted for weeks that summer in Philadelphia. The delegates could not agree, so they debated other parts of the proposal. One involved the names of the two houses of the legislature. Most spoke of them simply as the first branch and the second branch. We will speak of them by the names used today, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Next came the question, who could be elected to the House and Senate? Delegates did not take long to decide. Members of the House, they agreed, must be at least 25 years old. They must have been citizens of the United States for 7 years. And at the time of election, they must live in the state in which they are chosen. The delegates agreed that members of the Senate must be at least 30 years old. They also must have been a citizen of the United States for 9 years. And at the time of election, they too must live in the state in which they are chosen. But who would elect them? The question raised an interesting issue. It concerned democracy. In 1787, the word democracy meant something very different from what it means today. To many of the men meeting in Philadelphia, democracy meant mob rule. To give power to the people was an invitation to anarchy. Still, George Mason of Virginia argued for popular elections. The people will be represented, Mason said, so they should choose their representatives. James Wilson of Pennsylvania agreed. He stated firmly that the people must elect at least one branch of the national legislature. That, he said, was a basic condition for free government. The majority of the convention agreed with Mason. The delegates decided that members of the House of Representatives should be elected directly by the people. Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School in Connecticut. He says the delegates' decision to let people elect their representatives helped change the meaning of the word democracy.
The success of the American Constitutional Project has proved to the rest of the world that democracy can work, government of, by, and for the people, can survive and flourish, and this has been a model for the rest of the world.
However, most delegates agreed that the state legislatures would choose the representatives to the second legislative branch, the Senate. It remained that way for more than 100 years. In 1913, the states approved the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. This amendment legalized the direct election of senators by the people. How long would lawmakers serve? Roger Sherman of Connecticut thought representatives to the House should be elected every year. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts agreed. He thought a longer term would lead to a dictatorship. James Madison of Virginia protested. It will take almost 1 year, he said, just for lawmakers to travel to and from the seat of government. Madison proposed a 3-year term, but the delegates finally agreed on 2 years. There were many ideas about the term for senators. A few delegates thought they should be elected for life. In the end, the convention agreed on a Senate term of 6 years. Next came a debate about the pay for elected officials. How much should they get? Or should they be paid at all? Some delegates thought the states should pay their representatives to the national legislature. Others said the national legislature should decide its own pay and take it from the national treasury. That idea, James Madison argued, was shameful. He thought the amount should be set by the Constitution. Again, Madison lost the argument. The Constitution states only that lawmakers will be paid for their services and that the money will come from the national treasury. Finally, the time came for the convention to face the issue of representation in the House and Senate. The large states still wanted representation based on population, and the small states still wanted equal representation. The delegates had voted on the issue several times since the convention began. But both sides stood firm. Yet they knew they could not continue to vote forever, day after day. So the delegates did what large groups often do when they cannot reach agreement. They voted to create a committee. This grand committee would try to develop a compromise. The rest of the delegates would enjoy themselves during the July 4th holiday marking American independence. July 4th, Independence Day. It marked the 11th anniversary of America's Declaration of Independence from British rule. The celebration was especially important in Philadelphia. It was the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Now it was the city where a new nation was being created. Convention President George Washington led a group of delegates to a ceremony at a Philadelphia church. They heard a speech written especially for them. "Your country looks to you with both worry and hope," the speaker said. "Your country depends on your decisions. Your country believes that men such as you, who led us in our war for independence, will know how to plan a government that will be good for all Americans. Surely we have the ability to design a government that will protect the liberties we have won." After the speech, Benjamin Franklin urged the convention to ask for God's help. He said each meeting should begin with a prayer. Hugh Williamson of North Carolina quickly ended any discussion of Franklin's idea. The convention, he said, had no money to pay a minister to lead the delegates in prayer. On July 5th, the Grand Committee presented a two-part compromise. It provided something for large states and something for small states. It called for representation based on population in the House and for equal representation in the Senate. The committee said both parts of the compromise must be accepted or both rejected. Delegates debated the compromise for many days. They knew if they did not reach agreement, the convention would fail. Those were dark days in Philadelphia. Later, Luther Martin of Maryland noted that the newspapers reported on how much the delegates agreed. But that was not the truth. "We were on the edge of breaking up," Martin said. "We were held together only by the strength of a hair." Delegates Robert Yates and John Lansing of New York had left the convention in protest. But George Mason of Virginia declared he would bury his bones in Philadelphia before he would leave without an agreement. Even General George Washington was depressed. He wrote to Alexander Hamilton, who had returned to New York temporarily. "I am sorry you went away," Washington said. "Our discussions are now, if possible, worse than ever. There is little agreement on which a good government can be formed. I have lost almost all hope of seeing a successful end to the convention, and so I regret that I agreed to take part." On July 16th, the convention voted on the issue for the last time. It accepted what is called the Great Compromise. But even this agreement raised another problem. If representation was based on population, who would you count? Would you count just free people? Or would you count Negro slaves too?
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.